Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. Welcome, everyone, to Night Light. Welcome, light workers, light body energies, seekers of the light, watchers, wardens, indigos, soothsayers, mystics, questers and querents, journeymen and journeyers, seekers, star children and philosophers, and all those who are seeking reason and magic in these times of awakening, evolution, and transformation. I'm Barb DeLong, your host, and along with Jeannie and my guest tonight, John Nowinski, we invite you to come in out of the mainstream and gather around our nightlight in the darkness and confusion of the times. This show represents a sort of pit stop on your cosmic journey, so sit back, share your light with other light-minded people, and gather for a time to be sheltered from the storms of evolution and change. This is my own small oasis in the turmoil that we call creation. Share with us your light. We'll share ours with you, and with any luck, we can generate enough light to not only light our ways, but provide light enough for others who are seeking as well. These journeys that we're on began a very long time ago and will continue long after this lifetime has faded into memory. So gathering together, as we do every week, generates energy that can and is drawn on by countless others. Coming together and blending our lights creates energy that serves not only ourselves, but humanity as well. If you'd like to learn more about me, I invite you to visit my website, barbaradelong.com. There's a ton of information there, as well as links to my blogs and all of the other things that I'm involved in, crazy as it is. On Friday nights, I used to do a show. Oh, no, on Friday afternoons. Nothing wrong with me. On Friday afternoon, Night Light is on from 4 to 6, and that's a spiritually oriented program. And on that show, we do free psychic readings this coming Friday. My guest is going to be James Luce, and he and I will be doling out past lives for people. So if ever you wondered what you might have been and why, do tune in and give us a call, because we will be most happy to let you know what we see, what we feel, what we perceive as a past life that you may have had. I do Lizzie Star Show first Tuesday and the last Thursday of every month, and that show is on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 2 to 4. And I do invite you to visit us there as well. Lizzie is an amazing, amazing medium, and her daughter Adele is also coming right along too. So that's a fun show always to tune into. Thursday night, tomorrow at 8 p.m., I'm doing Cindy Plume's show. It's the Cindy Plume Show, and it will deal with spiritually oriented things as well. So this week I am definitely radioing it up. Jeannie is almost with us. She has KP duty tonight, so she is definitely going to be here. She just hasn't arrived quite yet. She is in the chat room, and if you have any questions, please IM them to her. She'll be happy to answer them, and if you have questions, you know, she will be happy to pass them on. Tonight's show is kind of interesting. We're going to be talking about paranormal experiences. We're going to be talking about paranormal investigations and basically what they involve and the kinds of things that can be encountered when on one of these paranormal investigations. I've had the privilege of going along on a couple of paranormal investigations, and it's always very exciting. It's really neat, and it's phenomenal when you take all of the information and you put it together and you present to someone, and it's fascinating as to how they can relate to the things that have been picked up, even though we had no information going in as to what was going on or what we might be experiencing. Paranormal investigations, quote unquote, or ghost hunting, as it has been called popularly on television, is probably new within the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years. I forget when TAPS came on air at first, but as far as I remember, TAPS was the first show, at least it was originated from the United States, that would investigate paranormal experiences that were taking place in people's houses. And please understand, when you say paranormal, you're not necessarily talking ghosts. You're talking a lot of other things, but not always ghosts. Oh, I see John is here, I hope. Let me see if I can find him. Hi, John, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Oh, yay, I was looking for a different phone number. I was going to go in and become the authority, but I was talking about how paranormal investigations, the kind that you do and the kind that they do on television and stuff, that's only been around for the last, what, 7-10 years, something like that?
Yeah, the sort of popularized version of it has really been around maybe going on about 10 to 15 years now, you know, and that's pretty much the version that people are most familiar with by television, you know, kicked off, like you said, by things like Ghost Hunters, which is actually a good representation of the spirit aspect of it. And, you know, other shows have come on since then, but that's been the longest running.
And you know, I think the thing that I want to put out there is that it's very rare, actually, to find a quote-unquote haunting in some of these houses where activity is taking place.
It is. And, you know, the thing that a lot of people don't realize with the TV shows is that there's many different categories to what investigators consider to be basically activity. A haunting, what people think of as a ghost, normally what people think of as something like a full-fledged apparition that's sighted, that's actually very, very rare. But there's also different categories. There's psychic phenomena, which isn't often considered ghosts but can still happen in a house. There's something that's called residual energy, which is energy left over from a specific event. So it might not actually be what we think of as a ghost as being an entity, but it's energy that's there for sure. And so that's kind of true, that the idea of a haunted house is actually very rare.
Yeah, I think that when this show came on the air, everybody, you know, anytime there was, you know, the house settling or squeaking or rapping or something, everybody panicked and thought, oh, my God, we're haunted. And reality is there are very few hauntings actually around. But actually, too, I think that the other thing that I want to really try to put across to people is that spirits visit us all the time. That doesn't
Right.
mean we're haunted.
Yep, and the other side to that, too, that unfortunately the TV shows in at least the last 5 years especially have really focused on, the energies that's out there, the experiences that people have had, the experiences that people continue to have on a daily basis are very, very rarely negative. And unfortunately, there's something we call the negativity overload, which is where a lot of these shows are going for the fright factor, the scary stories, things like that. And that makes a lot of people think that, oh, my gosh, that must be a lot of what's out there. And it's actually very rare. Most spirit encounters are positive, not only positive experiences and positive energies, but positive for the people that experience them. A lot of times it's relatives or friends who have passed that are simply coming back to basically visit in spirit form. There's communication aspect there that's not negative in any way. So, you know, the idea of what a lot of people think of as a really haunted house, which today kind of has almost a negative connotation with it, is also very rare, even from an investigation standpoint. A lot of the investigations that we get called in on, it's not because somebody has experienced something frightful in their house. They've simply experienced something they can't explain, and they're hoping that we can come in and maybe give them some insight to it. And it doesn't always turn out to be something, you know, bad. A lot of times it turns out to be something that simply needs to be acknowledged. And oftentimes it's able to be discovered that it's actually not something negative.
Well, the term paranormal, too, doesn't always refer to spirits. It's paranormal means other than normal. I mean,
right.
it could mean any number of things. I know a lot of people today have been talking about orbs and seeing orbs in photographs. And frankly, I've noticed that there has been an increase in the orbs that people are noticing in their pictures over the last probably 5 years. Have you experienced that same thing?
Yeah, there's definitely been an increase of things showing up. And as you said, the orbs is one of them. Certainly, there's a lot of them showing up in photographs now. There's a lot of other things that are coming out through technology that is becoming more prevalent. Which was there at one point, but with technology becoming basically handheld and cheaper, there's a lot more people that have access to a lot of things that they once never did. And also to, you know, mention what you were saying about paranormal, the word, I think that's very important, and I think that's something that gets lost far too often in discussions, really from not people that don't know any better, but basically from people that really don't have the background of understanding. All of these words, paranormal, unexplained, supernatural, extraordinary, extrasensory, all of these things denote something that's basically outside of our current understanding. So it doesn't denote something that is specifically a ghost or specifically an alien entity or something like that. It simply denotes something that, to our present understanding right now, using what we have, we simply can't explain it.
Right. And you know, I think that the important thing for people to understand, actually, one of the important things for people to understand is that as our consciousness expands, as we open to a greater realm and dimension that we live in, things like seeing spirits or feeling energy or seeing orbs or seeing auras is going to become common, and at that point it takes a lot of the fear and surprise out of a lot of these things that people are just now becoming sensitive to, that have always been there.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that's really, you know, talk about right now with the paranormal. That's something that we're seeing more so now in only the last year to 2 years than really ever before. And it's this fact that, you know, people, because there's so much access, through TV is a good medium too, but online and through, you know, shows like this that can be listened to from anywhere in the world and, you know, have guests calling from anywhere in the world, our brains are definitely evolving to the point that people are far more open and understanding to these things. And one of the things a lot of people say is, particularly with what one thinks is paranormal events, once you sort of become open to it, at least the perception of it, a lot of those things seem to come forth more clearly. With people who have experiences, a lot of times people who experience one thing and just can't get it out of their head because they realize there's something truly there, all of a sudden they find themselves connecting with other things in their surroundings. And we're seeing that on really a global scale.
Oh, yeah, and what I find fascinating is where people used to blame things that were unusual that were happening on spirits, now people are becoming more and more aware that lots of times what is occurring is because of emotional upset in the house, that it is the emotional upset that is causing strange things happening, not a spirit going wild.
Right, and that's something that, you know, with paranormal investigation, you know, a lot of that does get lost sort of in translation with the television shows, because certainly a lot of the television shows focus on things that are more entity related. But from parapsychology perspectives, from really an investigation and research standpoint, a lot of the sort of alternative explanations involve things like that, involve things like what would be considered psychic energy, which, as you mentioned, a good example is houses hold energy just like anything else does. So the more energy there is being put out there from individuals, sort of the more pent-up energy that happens. So houses can actually take on activity of their own that actually isn't what one would consider spirit activity, but is most certainly energy that's in that house.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Sure. Actually, we've had a number of examples like that. Some of the most prominent ones are examples where people are just having a hard time in a house. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on lately,
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of fighting in the house. And it's not even a matter of anger or things like that. There's just, you know, lots of people are on edge right now. There's a lot of energy behind ourselves, basically our psychic energy. And after a major fight or just an argument in a house, oftentimes there's just an energy that pretty much lingers there. And that energy can sort of fester and almost become negative in itself, just because of what it makes people feel like. A really good example for that on just a general scale is, if people go to a party and it's a party with, you know, friends or people from work, a lot of times there's so much energy around there and you could go from one group of people and be talking to them and feel very positive and then move and talk to another group of people and basically you feel your own energy change.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of energy is actually all over all the time. But in a house, it sort of gets sort of piled up in the house just like, you know, any other kind of thing. And it kind of needs cleaning every once in a while. Otherwise, it really becomes energy of that house. That can actually affect things.
Oh, absolutely. I know when I was looking for a house a number of years ago, I can remember drawing up in front of a house and saying to the realtor, nope, it's not a happy house. I don't even want to go in. And it's amazing how you can feel the energy of a house. And I know sometimes people who are having to sell their houses have their house on the market, and it's on the market, and it's on the market, and time goes on, and they don't understand why it's selling. And my first question is, but you don't want to sell it, so it's not selling, and you're
right,
putting that energy out there. And it's amazing. And sometimes I tell people, talk to the house, explain to the house that you have to sell it, that you know, for it to welcome somebody who would be good for it. And if they do that, and I know it sounds silly, but it does work. So that yes, houses do hold energy. I know when Patrick was very, very ill last year, there was a lot of tension in the house because he was passing over. And I know that not so much the house felt it, but I know all of the animals reacted to it.
Right.
And the animals, I think, are sometimes more sensitive than people. And the animals reacted to what was going on, and it took almost 6 months for them to calm back down.
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, that's where the interesting aspect of parapsychology comes into play, which is, you know, kind of what investigators do. That's a little bit, it combines exactly what the word says, paranormal investigation and really sort of psychological perception. And the aspect of parapsychology is just that. It's that, you know, activity might be happening in a house, but you kind of step back and you don't limit yourself to just thinking, oh, is it a ghost? As we most people would think, you start looking at other possibilities, and some of those possibilities fall into basically that energy that comes from people. And, you know, that energy is sort of psychological in a way, because it's coming from us. It's not coming from an external entity. But it is actually powerful enough to take on sort of a role of its own. And with a house, you get that a lot. Houses hold energy, and, you know, it's not just your energy. It could be energy from people in the past that live there, that came through there, that is basically becomes part of the house. It becomes the character of the house.
Do you feel that the older a house is, the more likely you are to find energy like that?
I think that's very often the case, not always. A newer place can have energy too. But with the older houses, what you get is you get so much energy that has come in and out of that house. And basically, because of that, everybody, every person, every family that has lived in a house has brought their own energy into that house. It's mixed around with the other energies that's there. So in an older house, I think you have more potential to have stronger energy. But there's certainly things that can happen in a newer house that would cause that to have energy. You also get that in a lot of places. And a good example of this is the Mark Twain House that's up in Hartford, which SGRI has had the opportunity to work with for a couple of years. And that's a house where there is spirit activity that happens in there, but there's also an energy that the house itself has. And you get that in a place where so many visitors have come, and everybody who walks through the threshold of that house has brought a little bit of their own energy there. So in a way, the house itself has almost grown its own character out of that. And there's energy that seems to be specific to the house that's not necessarily specific to a person that was there or is there now.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I've been up to the Mark Twain House, and it is an amazing an amazing place. You want to explain a little bit about the kind of equipment you use and stuff like that to people who, you know, have just had the experience of taps on television?
Yeah, well, we're pretty interesting organization because when we come in with an investigation, we have basically our equipment people, and they're people that operate similarly to what people are familiar with on TV. It's a team that focuses on everything from audio to video to thermographic imagers and things like that, which I'll explain. And then we also have a group of people that we bring in and we consult with who are basically what we call intuitive investigators, which are individuals who most of the time don't use equipment. Most of the time, like yourself, they are psychic. They have abilities that they've worked with throughout their lives. And basically their equipment they use is a pen and a piece of paper, and that's what they use to do their investigation. And that actually becomes really fascinating for us because we get to kind of put those two sides together, the what's thought of as the technical side with basically what's the psychic aspect, the intuition aspect. And more often than not only do those two sides coincide with each other, but oftentimes we'll have one side that will actually work off of the other. A good example of that is on a number of investigations, we have had areas of a property where our equipment was going off the roof, where we were having unusual photographs coming out of there, unusual video, unusual readings on some of the meters that we use. But the equipment doesn't actually tell you anything. you know, if the equipment goes off, it tells you there's energy there. It doesn't tell you that the energy is a spirit of a person. It doesn't tell you that the energy is coming from an object. It just tells you that there's energy there and it's being detected. So when we coincide that with the intuitives that we work with, it's really fascinating because they can walk into a room 90% of the time without ever knowing that our technical people picked up anything in that room, and they start coming up with basically the pieces that the technology can't come up with. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a name, sometimes it's a date, sometimes it's just the look and the feel of a person or a location. And then we get to step back and look at how those two things came together. And that's, from an investigation standpoint, that's something that's very fascinating. It's also something that in the earlier years of the television shows, you did see them working with a lot of psychics. Today, you don't see too much of that, mostly because psychic phenomena is kind of like any other phenomena that you're working with yourself. It doesn't really play well on camera. You know, a psychic can't really show you what they're picking up and how they're picking up on it, whereas the equipment, you know, has fancy lights on it and dials, and it beeps when it, you know, finds energy. So that tends to be more the focus of the TV shows. Is the equipment aspect.
Somebody just asked a question about how do the little apps like Ghost Radar work? I mean, do they work or are they just gizmos?
Well, they're actually pretty interesting. You know, most of them are what people would expect. Most of them are apps for phones that don't really seem to be work or anything like that. There are a couple, though, that over the last basically year or so, we've kind of experimented with. One of them is actually called just Ghost Radar, and it's an app for iPhones. And supposedly it picks out words that it hears from the area, and it identifies them as being words that were in some way spoken in the area that people didn't hear, but the phone picked it up. That one's been very interesting to us. We've actually used that on about 5 investigations so far, just as a test run, and it has come up with words that were very unique to the properties that we were at.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about it is, you know, it's pretty much impossible to say, yes, it actually works. but when you couple it with the other things that we use, which is the other thing that we do, as an investigation team, you never go on one piece of equipment. You always use multiple avenues to investigate. So as itself, it doesn't quite hold up to very much. But when you put it together with other things and it starts picking up things when the other equipment is, it becomes much more interesting.
Well, I know Jeannie has the ghost radar on her phone, and she left her phone on by accident. She left the ghost radar on, and when she picked it up in the morning, there were so many words that I said to her, I think you can string that together and have a sentence. And, she was able to do that. So that was pretty interesting. Another question I have for you, when you go in and you do an investigation of an older house, do you ever pick up information that may have been in a structure that had been there prior to the house that you're actually in?
Yes, and that's a good point, too. That's actually one of the reasons why equipment is not the best thing to use. It's not that you never want to use equipment, but that's actually another one, and probably I would have to say the number one reason why we really do work with intuitives on what we do is that, again, the equipment detects energy, but it doesn't tell you anything about the energy. And as we all know, especially living in places like the Northeast here, there are many sites that had things on them long before our houses ever existed. So the energy at a location, including spirit energy, might not even have anything to do with your house or whoever is living in it at the time. And our equipment, there's no way that the equipment would tell you that. So by going in with an intuitive, that actually helps, because what intuitives can do is, in a sense, they can pull apart the layers. And they can actually tell us if what they're picking up on seems like it's recent, or in the past, or in the very distant past. And that is definitely a case. I know, Barbara, you came to a farm that I work at, that we've done several investigations there. And that's a really good example, because the land has been there for so long, but it's undergone a lot of changes over the years. So things that are there now were not there at one point. Some things were built over things that used to be there. And so there's many, many layers to a single site. And it gets even more complicated because there's other layers that are sort of what we call the energetic realm. A lot of people call them fairies, which are fine. A lot of people call them sort of the sprites or things like that. But there's actually energies around us that aren't human energies, and they're not location energies. They're basically nature energies that have been there really since the dawn of time.
Now, are you talking about the elementals?
Yep, I'm talking about elementals.
Okay.
And that's an energy that, again, our equipment can actually pick that type of energy up, but it can't tell us that that's what that is.
Every now and then something on Facebook comes through that is just so fascinating that I just sit and stare at it. Did you see on Facebook the mummified fairy that they found in England?
Yes, I did. I've seen that, yep.
Is that a fake or is that for real?
That is actually a fake. The one that I know that I've seen reposted a few times was actually a prop that was made for a television show.
Oh, I'm so disappointed.
But, the interesting thing about fairies that I get, and again, it is a realm of unexplained investigations. So we've actually looked into a lot of fairy things. And there are some very interesting photographs that people have taken which show these glowing objects that pretty much look like what you might think that a fairy would look like. Of course, when you enhance them and you look at them, there's no distinguishing feature. I mean, they don't look like a small person with wings, but that's pretty much because that's really our sort of interpretation of what we think a fairy would look like.
In my experience, and now I believe in fairies, gnomes, and elves, But in my experience, what I have seen that I consider fairies, quote unquote, was much smaller than what they showed, you know, than what that was. Because
right.
I mean, what I've seen, they're smaller than a fingernail. You know, they're
yep.
smaller than they're itty bitties.
Right.
So, but you know, it just it was so cool. It was so sad that it was a great fake. It was a great fake.
Yeah, but even things like that really are something that I think shows the fact that, you know, people do want to believe it. But more so, even when something like that comes out, we don't, instead of just getting the typical, oh, you know, it was on the internet, it's not true, a lot of things now are sparking questions and discussion. And that's what's so wonderful, is that we do get people that see something like that and come to us and say, okay, I've believed about fairies my whole life. You know, what is it? What's the true story? What's the real background? And so the fact that people are using that to basically ask questions and start expanding their mind, I think is really great. And even with the television shows, even with the ones that are not really great television shows as far as showing the reality goes, it is still making people question. It is still making people ask, what is it all about? What's the real story there?
Well, I firmly believe that science fiction is the universe's way of making our minds ready to accept a different reality.
Right.
And if you look at Star Trek when it first started, you know, the doors that open and shut, you know, that was really cool when it came on TV, but the reality is the doors open and shut for us all the time here in all sorts of places, and we take it as just absolute, you know, it's a given. And their tricorders and the things that they flip open and, you know, beam me up. I mean, our cell phones do that. Well, not the beaming up, but but almost.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I think that's a very good point, is that, you know, a lot of it basically takes that one person who sees something on TV, you know, even in a science fiction show like that, and really sort of dedicates themselves to exploring it. And, you know, with unexplained phenomena, that's certainly been a big positive. And with the TV shows, it's been a great opportunity to really show people that, you know, there's no one place that is completely alone when it comes to the paranormal. You know, as a researcher and investigator, you know, we've known it our whole lives. We've always known that there's other stories out there. But when you get to something like, for example, there's a TV show called Destination Truth, which is actually one of the ones that I don't mind watching. And the reason why I like it so much is that they go all over the world and show that there are these unexplained stories that are exactly the same stories that you're hearing here in America, but they had them in, for example, Africa thousands of years ago, or Europe or Asia. And what it shows people is that, you know, basically, as the old saying goes, we're not alone. And
oh, gosh, no.
It's not just one person saying, oh, I had a psychic experience, or I had a ghost, and, you know, they're just a single person that nobody else has had that experience. And from SGRA, that's one of the most fascinating things for me. I love getting emails from people, and the very first sentence is, I've never told anybody this because nobody's ever going to believe it, but, and they go on to tell me something, and I love being able to respond to them with the opening sentence of, actually, you're not the first person to say that.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I have been amazed at the evolution of is the orbs. I mean, you know, people found them in their photographs, and people were saying, oh, that's just dust, or that's the flash equipment. And then within the last 2 years, they were doing an investigation down, I believe it's in South America someplace, and they set their cameras up to take pictures, time-lapse pictures, and they found that in some of the pyramids down there, there were orbs right around dawn and dusk, you know, those times where there's the light is so very it's almost a gloaming, that they photographed so many orbs they could not believe them, and they were around only the oldest of the pyramids, not the youngest, but the very, very oldest of the pyramids were just swarming with these orbs, and the newer pyramids that were only a couple thousand years old did not have that spirit energy around them.
Right.
Now, you know, I have tons of pictures of orbs. I've been collecting them, you know, whenever I get orbs in any of my photographs, I put them in a folder because, you know, you can actually blow them up and you can see figures in some of them. I mean, what is your experience with them, those that are not dust or flash equipment?
Well, I think that's just it. You know, with the sort of orbs that have come out, you know, there's a lot of people now that as soon as they see one, they quickly say, oh, it's dust or moisture. But from the technology standpoint, because there has been such a spike in photographs of orbs, we've basically gotten very good at detecting the ones that are explainable and the ones that might not be. And what we're seeing is that if you really take a close look, there's a lot of factors in the ones that simply can't be brushed off as being dust or moisture in the air or a light reflection from somewhere. And those ones are really fascinating because, again, those ones are true unknowns. We simply can't explain it. And a lot of them are cropping up in places like the pyramids, places like Stonehenge, places that have not only ancient history to them, but what we do most certainly know is having ancient energy to them. Mm-hmm. So they most certainly seem to be connected with something, whether it's a spiritual connection or whether it's that sort of earth energy connection. But there are orbs that are most definitely not dust, not moisture, and can't be explained away as simple light reflection or a flash. As I said, you know, from an investigation standpoint, they're actually becoming more and more easy to identify out of the other ones.
Oh yeah, I know when Patrick and I were doing all of the chambers, it was unusual to get a picture of a chamber that did not have an orb in it. It was just phenomenal, and it was sort of like, okay, so what is this symbolizing? What is it here? Is it because, you know, as an intuitive, I could be in the chamber and I did not feel a presence and I did not feel, you know, anything. I felt warm and I felt comfortable and I felt protected. And I was never able to put my finger on exactly what those orbs were representing because it didn't feel like they were people, but it did feel like they were energy.
Right, right. And I think, you know, that's something that is definitely going to be and has certainly been in some cases a real focus of investigation coming up. And especially, again, with technology becoming so small and affordable by people, people have access to things that you know we never imagined before. You know, it's hard to imagine that we have laptops when basically less than 50 years ago computers took up an entire room.
All right.
And so now we have things that we use as investigation teams. We have infrared thermometers and heat imaging technology that we can use in a camera and set it up and see that right away. And that's technology that not only used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but pretty much if you weren't, you know, a mainstream university, you didn't have a chance about getting your hands on anything like that.
Now
we actually have it in our kits that we can take it with us.
How do you explain the shift in temperature when spirits are around?
Oh, well, that actually, you know, that gets into the geeky science aspect of what we do. And pretty much for something to exist, it needs to draw energy from something. And the easiest way to think about that is if you light a match and you see the light of the flame, you feel the heat. Well, that light and that heat is all coming because that is drawing energy from something. It's basically drawing energy from the oxygen in the air. So the change in temperature that people feel when there's actually a spirit around, it basically is equated to the fact that in order for something to manifest, it needs to pull energy from something. And the easiest, most abundant source of energy is pretty much heat and basically atmosphere in a location. So the more a spirit is manifesting, that's when you start seeing these dramatic drops in temperature. And it's not a gradual thing. It's something where one area of a room can go from being 80 degrees to 40 degrees. And it's, you know, within a few feet. And,
yeah.
You know, that's very interesting because that is, again, all actually detectable by using technology. We have infrared thermometers now where we can actually measure what's called cold spots, which is believed to be areas that energies are manifesting themselves or making themselves known. And we've had instances where we can actually see these cold spots moving around a room. You know, that's something that, again, we weren't able to do even 10 years ago.
Well, don't they also draw energy from us because we, of course, are electromagnetic beings?
Right. Yep, certainly. And also, I think that's one reason why many people often have connections with these spirit energies is that, in a way, they're sort of feeding off of our energy as well. So a lot of that time, you know, we feel a connection with these energies because we're sharing energy. We're sharing space with them. It's interesting you were saying about people talking to their house and things like that. Well, I've known countless people that have had basically house spirits that are energies in their house that they identify as being almost another person living in the house. And they will actually talk to it openly and things like that. It's a detectable energy that's there in the house, and they feel that it is another character.
Well, yeah, we have a spirit here in this house that I don't believe is a relative that took great joy in driving Patrick crazy because he was a contractor and when he hung a picture, it stayed straight. It never went crooked. And he announced that. And because of that, every picture in this house was constantly off kilter because the spirit just, you know, would go around at night or the energy or whoever it was and make every picture crooked. And he would get up in the morning and I told him that was what was going on. And he told me that they just weren't hung right. And after rehanging everything in the house, he finally had to give up and apologize to the spirit. And every now and then he would be sitting in the living room and I could hear him saying, "Look, just leave them straight. Just leave them straight for a week. That's all I ask is just give me a week." And for a week, everything was straight, and then it went crooked again. And so it was almost a ritual with him to ask the house to let the pictures hang straight. So
yep.
Even though he didn't believe in any of this stuff, of course, have you guys ever investigated a vortex?
We have actually. Vortexes are really fascinating. From a number of standpoints, because, first of all, there's not very many comprehensive maps of vortexes because, you know, it's something that for the most part has been stumbled upon unless it's something that's a major place like Stonehenge, for example, where it's basically ancient history. But for example, here in the United States, where we've built up so much, we've lost a lot of where these vortexes were, but of course the vortexes themselves still exist. It's not that they go away just because an area that was marking them is removed. And what's also really fascinating from a paranormal standpoint is that a way to find these locations is to basically look for really what is considered modernly as paranormal hotspots, which are pretty much the same as what you would think of as a vortex. A great example of that is the Hudson Valley region here. We have had everything in a very small area, from major UFO sightings to Bigfoot sightings to major haunted locations with long histories of things, all the way on back to Native American sacred sites, areas where the Native Americans believed the sky people came down and interacted with them. And this is all in a very condensed area. And so from a modern standpoint, when we look at that, we kind of feel that that's what the idea of a vortex is. It's something where these energies, for whatever reason, can become stronger and more focused and actually start coming through. We've looked into a lot of that, particularly, again, in this area, is great because we're surrounded by this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dudleytown is one of those areas. Have you been able to investigate that?
We visited up there several years ago, almost back to the beginning of the group, back in 1996 and 97, when the land was still open. And that's actually, that brings up a really good point, because with a lot of places, and Dudleytown being one of them, there's always this pop culture story of going on there.
It just occurred to me, John, that you know, you and I live in New England, and so Dudleytown is like, you want to explain what Dudleytown is so that anybody out there who doesn't happen to live in Connecticut knows what we're talking about?
Yeah. Well, the pop culture version of it is that Dudleytown was a town where strange and unusual things started happening, which were considered demonic things. And basically, according to the story, everybody just kind of up and left the area because they got scared off. And what's interesting is that, you know, that's kind of the modern story of Dudleytown. But the area that Dudleytown sits on is located right near what's called Mohawk Mountain, which is one of the tallest mountains in Connecticut. And it also just happens to be that on the top of that mountain was where the Native American tribes believed that their sky gods came down and actually interacted with them. Mm-hmm. So the story of Dudleytown, as far as the pop culture aspect, it doesn't really add up, because there is actually explanations of things that happened there. The number one being, it was never actually a town. It was an extension of what's called Cornwall Village, which is there. And the reason why most people left wasn't really anything demonic. It was the fact that they built the town on the side of a mountain, and anytime it rained, the town would pretty much get flooded out. So it didn't take them very long to realize that it was a bad place to build. However, again, going back to the idea of vortexes and things like that, the whole area was considered Native American sacred ground, and there are massive amounts of paranormal activity that happened there. Again, everything from vivid ghost experiences where people have been hiking in the woods there and passed individuals that they swore were actual people, but when they turned around, they were gone. There's also Bigfoot sightings in that area fairly regularly. There are UFO sightings probably at least one or two times a month. Sometimes there are massive UFO sightings. And it's all in that area that's focused around where Dudleytown is actually located, where that whole area was.
A number of years ago, before they put the restriction on it, I hiked in. I didn't realize that it was a hike. I didn't understand the Appalachian Trail. I thought it was a, a nice little path we could wander down. And then, you know, passing people with backpacks and tents on their backs, I realized that perhaps I was maybe a little misinformed. But as we got closer and closer to the site where the foundations were, the thing that struck me so profoundly was that we were in dense woods, big forest, huge forest, and there were no bugs.
Right.
There were no birds. There was no insect life at all. And I have yet been, I am at a loss at how to explain that.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that, it is really interesting because it has bridged that gap between paranormal and basically what people would consider as not paranormal, because even people that have gone there that don't subscribe to any of the supposed haunted history of the place have all come out with that same experience where they get to a particular part of those woods and suddenly notice that there is just no noise and the birds just disappear. There's no sounds. Even people have described the wind coming through the trees and just not making a sound. And what's really interesting about that is there are other parts of the world that are called cones of silence or silence areas where there's very similar reports to that, where people will go to the particular areas and suddenly everything just goes quiet.
And there's no explanation?
No, there has not been any scientific explanation. And the interesting thing is that there's many places that have been doing pretty extensive research into those areas. There's a very famous area that's actually in Mexico, which has a lot of similar stories to that, where people have gone, again, not paranormal people, just actual researchers, have gone to that area with magnetometers and all sorts of equipment, and just found that there's no explanation yet for it, but there's areas of silence, and there's areas that there just doesn't seem to be any outside noise that happens when they're there. And it's very similar to what people have reported about when hiking through the Appalachian Trail in that area.
Well, it was the strangest thing. I mean, it was. You're right. It was like a cone of silence. And I got down on hands and knees and looked for bugs. I thought there have to be ants here. There was no animal life from what I could see. And I wasn't going to go digging, but. It just seems devoid of life, and yet the trees were growing and stuff like that. But that was it was fascinating. And you know, when I mentioned vortex, I think that I'm beginning to suspect, and it's just my opinion, it's not documented any place, that a lot of these vortexes, a lot of these even crop circles, I think to me in some way they represent portals into other dimensions. We just don't know how to cross the portal.
Yeah, and I think, that's something that has become a really interesting study in the paranormal world is these portals, these vortexes between basically these other worlds. And one of the things that it really shows us, and it's something that, again, TV shows like on the Discovery Channel and things like that have actually kind of made the average everyday person understand some of these concepts because a lot of them is technobabble. And
yeah,
when it comes into things like alternate dimensions and vortexes, most people, it can blow your mind pretty easily. But what's so interesting is that all that kind of aspect is supported by science. All the ideas of these other dimensions, all the ideas of there possibly being these vortexes, this is all actually what's really unified into quantum physics. And it's things that is now starting to not only become popular, but starting to become explored by sort of these outer reaches of science. And that's really important, because what we've seen in history is that once these outer reaches of science start to do things, they basically gradually pull into the mainstream science. And so, you know, we're looking at this where there's a lot of science right now that is teetering on what people would really consider supernatural in a way, but is actually being quite supported by a lot of research.
Well, look at near-death experiences. I mean, they used to say, oh, that was just the brain going through, you know, a process of having a lack of oxygen or whatever, and now there's that doctor that was dead for quite a bit of time, a period of time, and he was brought back, and he said, uh-uh.
Yep.
I saw angels. I saw the other side. There is something over there, and it wasn't just a deficiency of something to my brain, because my brain was dead, and
right.
I was legally dead.
Yep, and even from a paranormal standpoint, one of the really fun things for us is that when some of these new terminologies and new aspects of science start to come out more into the light, it makes us look back on things that happened in the past and realize that, you know, it might have sounded crazy when it was proposed 20 years ago, but now it's actually starting to line up with a little bit more support. You know, for example, with UFOs, a lot of, you know, everybody has always said, oh, well, if it was a physical craft, to come here from another planet would take, you know, millions and millions of years, so that kind of interspace travel would be impossible. Well, nobody really ever argued that, because it was true. To do that in one straight line would take millions of years, if not billions of years, and would pretty much be impossible. But now with this idea of wormholes actually existing out there in the world, and
mm-hmm.
it no longer being a question of do they exist, but they do exist. It's just a matter of where are they. And, you know, that we don't have the current technology to sort of harness them, but that doesn't mean that something or a civilization that hasn't been around for far longer than we have hasn't figured it out. So
it
opens up a whole different line of questioning.
Michio Kaka, or whatever his name is, he said that really we weren't just, when we're talking about extraterrestrials I think it's kind of neat, because we call them aliens, and that just means that they aren't indigenous to this earth, or maybe not indigenous to the earth at this point in time.
Right.
So that they really, I mean, people who are from another country are aliens. So calling these people who are, or these beings that or these consciousnesses that are theoretically in these unidentified flying objects, aliens, to me is, I don't know, I almost have to laugh at it, because, you know, more and more and more the almost accepted philosophy is that they really are ancestors, or we are, you know, either we are their ancestors or they are our ancestors. I'm not sure which way you want to put it, but
right.
that there has to be a connection, because certainly if they were out to destroy us, and, you know, there are so many science fiction movies and books that talk about the destruction that comes from the sky, if they wanted to wipe us out, they could have done it a long time ago, and they've never done that.
Right.
So I know you do, you know, study the UFOs as well, and I, you know, it feels to me as though the sightings are becoming more and more and more frequent.
They definitely are, and you know, not just the sightings. You know, I mean, there had always been individual sightings and things like that, but really, what started to happen in pretty much the 70s and the 80s was what's considered the mass sightings, what's considered these events where it's not just one person or a family or a small group of people, it's hundreds of people from different locations and different views of the same object. And when that happens, from an investigation standpoint, it sort of takes it up to the next level. Because what's happening is, you know, if one person or one group from a particular area are seeing something in the sky, it can very easily be said, well, maybe they were seeing something that was a reflection or an object that was from somewhere else. But when you get these people that are in different locations but are clearly observing the same object in the sky, it becomes much more difficult to sort of discount. And a good example from our local area in the Hudson Valley here, in the 1980s, we had what was called the Hudson Valley sightings. And these were sightings of craft that hundreds of witnesses saw. And these craft weren't just little blobs that went through the air. These craft were slow-moving objects that people actually had the time to pull over in their cars or go out of their houses and actually get their neighbors out from surrounding houses and watch as this massive object passed overhead. And, you know, when something like that happens, it really causes you to stop and think, you know, obviously they weren't trying to hide because they didn't do a very good job of it. And anybody who saw those objects, you know, nobody believed that they were simply aircraft flying overhead, when you had witnesses who were police officers, air traffic controllers, pilots themselves. And that's something where, you know, it might be very easy for somebody to discount a small group of people and say, oh, well, all seven of those people, they didn't have any background, so they didn't really know what they were looking at. But when you get hundreds of people over a two-state area who witnessed these objects, you know, you can't point to every single one of them and say, well, they didn't know what they were looking at, or they were too young, or they were too old, or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. You just can't discount that many people.
No, and you have the Phoenix Lights, you have the Battle of Los Angeles, you have the Washington sighting. I mean, and they are becoming larger and larger and larger sightings. And I think there are a lot of famous psychics out there that are predicting that there will be a contact or a communication or, you know, a massive something. And they're all saying it's going to happen very soon. I'm not so sure I agree with that. I do believe that if and when there is communication, it will not be, you know, to a government. It will be telepathically to the world.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And we talked, you know, more recently about the whole idea of the 2012 thing. And, you know, of course, Hollywood had its fun with that. But within the sort of psychic community and the paranormal community, you know, everybody always felt like 2012 was going to be what we call a shift in consciousness, an awakening, you know, a rising, that kind of thing. Nobody ever thought it was going to be a doomsday aspect. And, you know, from purely a research standpoint and being interacting with the public so much through the library lectures that we do and the website work and things like that, we most certainly saw in the last 2 years a very present shift in people's basically understanding and consciousness and willingness to accept that there's so much out there that we simply can't just explain away.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
That on a like you said, on a global scale, is certainly becoming more present. And if there is going to be some sort of announcement to the world that extraterrestrials, aliens, other dimensional beings, whatever they may be, are not only existing but are here, it's going to be something that's going to be able to be sort of reached out to the entire world as opposed to through a particular medium,
a
particular government or something like that.
Well, I think that first of all, governments would try to control it.
Right.
So that I don't think that they would even recognize a government. I think that they would be approach, personally, this is just my belief system, but I think they would approach us as a species, not as you know, independent countries or governments or anything. I think that they would, you know, be talking to us as humanity. So I think that governments will not be able to control this, and so governments will be very much against it. And with the way governments are going today, it's almost frightening, but it would seem to me that governments would be very sad. And, you know, it's interesting because in the Bible it talks about the return and how If you go by the fact that perhaps the angels and the gods were actually aliens, that when they returned, that the governments would be sad and angry and fight against the return of the creators. So I can see that happening.
Yeah, well, definitely. You know, unfortunately, government system is about the control aspect. It always has been. You know, and with something that is affects things on a humane level, where it's, you know, a worldwide aspect, there's simply no single way to go through it. And so, yeah, I think, you know, if beings are going to make themselves known, it's certainly going to be something that can be reached out to people on an individual level, versus on any kind of a group or organizational level.
Yeah, I would like to see it. I just don't know that humanity is going to be ever at a place, at least in my lifetime, where we aren't fighting amongst so much amongst ourselves that you know, we're ready to step into a more universal community, because, you know, we're screwing up royally down here now.
Yeah, I think we still have a long way to go. And, you know, I think that also brings up a good point about the idea of other species being out there in the universe. You know, one of the things from a paranormal standpoint is that, you know, a lot of people see us almost arguing against science all the time. And that's not always the case. You know, we really try to basically work with science. But one of the things specifically with the idea of aliens out there is that there's so much of a focus really on ourselves, and a lot of that has to do with the aspect of science can't always look out of the bubble that it doesn't know. So it knows Earth, it knows people, and that's what it bases everything on. But, you know, by that very same sort of virtue, you look at Earth and you know, not even considering our species on planet Earth, but our Earth is not even outside of its infancy stage yet. And, you know, people, we like to think, oh, you know, we've been here for you know, millions of years, so we're this really built-up species. But in the grand scheme of things, we're really not. We're not something that's been around very long. There's plenty of places out there that have been around for billions and billions of years before Earth ever even came into existence.
Well, heck, John, haven't cockroaches been here longer than we have?
Yeah, there's a lot of species that have certainly been here longer than we have. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things in nature like alligators and crocodiles that have been here longer than people have. You know, so the idea that we're really such an advanced species and that nothing else out there could possibly be anything near us is always kind of, personally, something that always makes me, you know, laugh. And not only that, but the idea that we're looking to other planets and saying, well, that other planet couldn't have life because we couldn't be sustained there. You know, we're very much limiting ourselves.
Oh, if we were that highly evolved, there would be peace and there would be love and there would be no hunger and there would be no war.
Right.
We aren't quite there yet. But, you know, I think that one of the aspects of your investigation that we haven't touched on that, that I do want to touch on a little bit here is you're working with someone who does animal communication.
Yeah, which is actually something that, you know, talk about being two things that bridge the gap there. Two things that I've always been extremely passionate about have been pretty much paranormal research and animals. And, you know, one of the things that anybody who has passions understands is that, you know, passions are never very separate. There's always something that crosses the line, so to speak. And with animal communication, that's something that has certainly crossed the line. Whereas there's a lot of aspects to animal communication that is intuitive and psychic and crosses the line into spiritualism and ghosts and energies being around us. Anybody who has been able to own an animal knows that animals not only have their own personality, but they have their own energy about them. And that energy, just like a person's energy, it doesn't go away when the physical animal goes away.
Oh, my goodness. No, I have a resident ghost here who is a cat. And it's my cat, Smudge. And when Patrick moved in here, I said to him, there is a ghost, and it's Smudge. And he's an all-gray cat. And Patrick just said, yeah, yeah. And it was maybe a month or two later that he was sitting at the kitchen table, and he looked. I saw him look down at the floor, and I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "Well, a cat just, you know, rubbed against my feet, my legs, and I looked under the table, and it was a gray cat." And now at that moment, we had nine cats. He said, "We don't have a gray cat." And I said, "Oh, that was Smudge." And he said, "Yeah, right." And he saw Smudge a number of times, and he finally had to admit that yep, there was a cat here. and not that he believed in ghosts, but he believed in Smudge. And
right.
It was really kind of funny because he would say to you, you know, "I don't believe in ghosts, but there is a cat that's here that I can't, you know, account for." And it was really quite fascinating.
Yep. And, you know, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people personally, you know, including myself, that have had experiences like that too. And it is always funny because there are always people, you know, with the paranormal, it's also, you know, a lot of people don't want to subscribe to the paranormal. But, you know, there's always things that kind of catch them, and animals are one of those things. You know, animal energy, you can talk to somebody who owns animals and talk about energy, and just like you said, a lot of people have stories where, you know, an animal passed away, and they had another animal come into the house, and, you know, they don't really believe in spirits and energy, but they have a cat that always seems to interact with something that's not there, and they just notice that it's always in the same place that their former cat, you know, loves, and that was their spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they don't really believe in spirits and energy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the thing that surprises me is that people don't understand that animals are extraordinarily intelligent, and especially. They're especially sensitive to anything in alpha, and
mm-hmm.
and anyone who is you know meditated, you know, to any degree will understand what I say with alpha. If you can go into alpha, you can communicate with your animals, and you literally can. The thing that fascinates me so much is that animals, while we think that they understand our words, the reality is they understand the pictures that we send to a far greater degree. And if you can go into alpha and send your pet a picture of what you want it to do, dogs are easier than cats. Cats don't, you know, they get the picture. They just don't always decide to cooperate. But I have found that all you need to do is send a clear picture and wait patiently. And if you're in alpha, if you're truly in alpha, that your pet will respond to you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that, you know, and it's very similar to paranormal work, and whether you're dealing with UFOs or ghosts, it's all really a matter of perspective. And, you know, that's just it. The thing that a lot of people have that hold them back is something that I always tell people, again, whether we're dealing with ghosts or spirits or UFOs or talking with animals, is that we come with our own preconceived notions. And one of the biggest ones in communication, whether it's telepathic communication with other people or psychic communication with spirits or intuitive communication with animals, one of the things that people always holds people back is the idea that in order to communicate, you have to talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of us are so used to talking, and that's how we communicate, that we've never tried communicating with pictures in visual spectrums and with our minds and projecting and things like that. So a lot of people just haven't ever experienced that. They haven't ever tried that. And with animals, that's just it. Whether you're dealing with a dog or a cat or all the way on up to a horse, you know, they communicate differently. And it's not that we can't communicate on that level. It's just that most people don't really ever try. And the way they communicate most often is visually. They send us pictures and they send us things. And we might think it's completely off. But it's basically, we have to not expect too much from it.
Yeah. Well, I can remember I had a cat named Angel, and he was an attack cat, and nobody got along with him except me, but he was my baby. And he was bipolar, and I had to medicate him every night. And when I would finally remember, I have to give Angel his medication, it was just a cream I had to put in his ear. But he knew I was getting ready to do it, and he would disappear.
Right.
And I would get it, and I would sit there, and I would have to take deep breaths, and I would have to say, okay. And I would calm myself down, and I would see Angel curled up someplace, you know, feeling very... very good about the fact that he'd avoided me, and I would see him get up and stretch and walk to wherever the food dish was and get a snack and then come and jump up on the bed and sit next to me. And within, you know, 10, 15 minutes, there he was. And I sometimes think he knew he didn't want to come, but there he was. and I would grab him and I would give him the medication in his ear and we would go about our business. But I think when animals do respond to our tone of voice, there's no doubt about that. But they're responding to a tone, and I think they more respond to if we can picture what we want them to do.
Right, right. And the interesting thing about that too is that especially when you see it in a case where you know animals obviously respond to tone and they obviously respond to cues. But when it comes to animal communication, there's so many instances that you can see it where you're actually not there with the animal and
mm-hmm.
you're still getting a message from them and vice versa. So it's interesting because when something like that happens, you know it's not because you said something or you gave a cue because you're not even there with them. It's just you might get a sense that, you know, specifically on something like a farm, like where we work with so many different animals, you might just suddenly get a sense that one of the animals is needing something or has done something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're not even there. You're nowhere near the animal. You haven't heard it or you know, visually seen it. But you get a sense that, you know, the food pail was knocked over or something like that. And you go there, and sure enough, there it is.
Well,
and,
I know.
You know, that happens in basically in the house, too, very often, where, you know, somebody doesn't see a cat. The cat might be hiding. And they start to basically visualize themselves, and either they visualize exactly where the cat is and, you know, not a typical hiding place for that particular animal, or they start thinking about the cat and thinking about the cat being with them. And as you said, you know, 10 minutes later, the cat comes waltzing in right up to them, you know, as if they called it, but mm-hmm. they know they didn't actually say anything and the cat didn't see them. But somehow the cat knew that they were calling for it.
Well, my favorite story about communication is that I have a cat who's, she's hyper. And she was having accidents all over the house, and it was very annoying. And so she'd been tested. There was nothing wrong with her. They said it was just emotional. And so I got desperate. And I've only been in this field 50 years, so I dialed up a pet psychic on the computer, and I filled out the questionnaire, and I gave the problem and the name of the cat, and then I got to the point where I could book the appointment. I was gonna pay for a reading. I got up to the point where, you know, they told me how much it was, and it was $500 for half an hour. And at that point, I turned the computer off, and I sat down, and I put the cat on my chest, and I said, we're going to meditate. I'm a psychic, for Pete's sakes, and I'm not paying $500 to another psychic. I'm just not doing it. And I said to Yoda, you know, now shut your eyes. We're going to calm down and breathe. And I shut my eyes, and I opened my eyes, and I said, shut your eyes. And she shut her eyes. And I just, you know, I pictured myself upset at the places that she was using as a litter box that did not have a litter box present, and I showed myself confused, and you know, I was staring at her, and you know, I just kind of put my hands up like, why? And I sat there for a minute, and suddenly I saw her in a litter box and one of the other cats jumping at her.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could, you know, and I opened my eyes and I said, that's it. You need another a litter box in a different place. I got another litter box, put it in a different place, and she did not have accidents again.
Yep. And that's the thing. I think, you know, also with animal communication, so many people are expecting that when they sit down and they meditate and they start communicating with their animals, that they're suddenly going to get this novel. That they're suddenly going to get, you know, the keys to the kingdom, as people say. And, you know, the animals are going to tell them this amazing story of how integral their connection is to the world. And a lot of times, no. You know, a lot of times it's a simple thing. Animals are, you know, not, they're actually far more intelligent than people, but they're not as complex as people. They don't have the same cares as people do. So a lot of animal communication, you know, people are expecting a people conversation, and mm-hmm. that's not what they're going to get. They're not going to get the way to win the lotto, because the animals don't really care. It might be nice if they did, but they don't. They might care about where their litter box is placed, or what time of day they get fed, or what kind of food they get, because they like the food that they were getting 2 weeks ago, but when you changed it, they didn't like it. So it's little things like that. And the thing is that the little things are what people most often write off, because mm-hmm. they're expecting something bigger. They're expecting that they're going to get a novel. And so when they get, I don't really like my bed in this corner of the room because I like to sit in the sun, which is why I sprawl out on the dining room table.
Yeah.
They write it off because they think, oh, no, you know, my animal wouldn't be saying something like that. That's too simple.
Well, certainly I think that there are some animals that are more intelligent than others. But how about things like ants? I mean, can you actually make the ants leave your house, or you know, is there a certain level of brain mass that they have to have in order to communicate?
Well, that's, I mean, that is a pretty interesting question. You know, I'm actually pretty new to the aspect of animal communication itself, as in doing it. And I think mostly because, you know, most of us are so busy with our everyday lives that we don't think about sitting down and doing it. The interesting thing I find is that, again, going kind of back to the whole energy aspect, everything does have energy. So I think on some level that even talking to something as little as an ant would probably be possible, because an ant definitely, it's biological, it has some energy to it, so there's obviously some semblance of intelligence there, except the complexity aspect is there too. An ant is certainly not as complex as we are or other animals are, so it's a little bit more difficult to sort of talk on their level.
I would think that the ants are more like the Borg.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, an ant is basically a worker animal. It goes from point A to point B, and that's pretty much how they go throughout their day. So, you know, there's probably some semblance of basically, just like the Borg, that collective consciousness there. But it's probably very basic.
Yeah, I think for me it's easier to just off them. but you know, when it comes to animal communication, especially, I the name of the farm that you are connected to is
it's Lockett's Meadow Farm, and it's actually in Bethany, Connecticut here.
Basically, she rescues animals, right?
Yeah, and that's actually what makes it such a fun place to sort of hone in the skill of animal communication. All the animals on the farm are rescued, and they all come from a different circumstance. And what makes it interesting for the animal communication is that, you know, if you're dealing with cats and dogs, even though they're from different families and things like that, a lot of them have somewhat of the basic story. But when you're dealing with animals that are from all over the place with all different backgrounds, it's interesting to see what people sort of perceive from them. Because if you're looking at a horse, you really have no basis on what the background of that story might be. So what you get, you can't really brush it off as easily as being, oh, my animal wouldn't say that, or, you know, that's just what I would think a cat would say, because most people don't have interactions with something like a horse.
Yeah, that's true.
So when, you know, one of the situations is we had actually last year when we did an animal communication workshop was, you know, we were doing a meditation and asking people to just sort of say what popped into their head. And one of the people in the back of the group really looked like they wanted to say something but kind of kept letting everybody go over to them. So finally we called on them, and they said, well, they were getting the visual of a horse trailer, but, you know, and a trailer ride, and not quite knowing where they were going. But, you know, all horses must have that, so they didn't really think it was anything. And it was really funny because that was actually the story. That was exactly what this horse was trying to say. It was that this horse had an experience while in the trailer, and it was different than all the other horses. So that person was actually getting exactly what that horse was really putting out there. But because they just figured that every horse has been in a trailer, so it must not be the story, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of just sort of, you know, wiped it off and didn't really say anything.
Yeah, I know that there are times where now here's a question. Now I believe that animals have spirits as individual as human, as ours. I do believe that they actually reincarnate. And we often have and I don't believe that you jump, you know, species to species. I think you stay within your own species when you reincarnate. I'm wondering, I know that, that people, individuals, often have things happen to them that are a reflection of a past life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if horses and dogs and cats, but more specifically horses, I'm wondering if they have the same experience.
I would say, you know, from the basically exposure to different animals on a little bit of that intuitive psychic level, I definitely think they would. What's interesting is that the sort of area of animal communication and pet psychic aspects, that's actually something that's really pretty new. Pet psychics have kind of been around for a very long time, but really the focus on sort of studying aspects of that a little bit more is much more new. And I really would not be surprised if we find that there begins to be a little bit more exploration of topics like that. And I wouldn't be too surprised if something like a cat or even, like you said, a horse, you know, has some connections with past life aspects where, you know, something that's affecting them today might actually be able to be associated with maybe a past life that they had.
Well, it's things like phobias. In my experience, phobias with humans often come from a traumatic experience in a past life, because a phobia is an unexplained fear.
Right.
And so that if you have an unexplained fear, in fear of, oh, I don't know, elevators or whatever, that if you do past life experience, you can find it. Well, there are often horses, especially, because Jeannie works with horses a lot, and there are probably times when they suddenly are spooked by something that normally wouldn't spook them. Or
right.
that I'm wondering if they have a past life experience that is flashing at that moment and creating a problem. And of course, I don't know how you would deal with it, to be honest with you. I mean, you can't get rid of a person's phobia, so I'm pretty sure you couldn't get rid of a horse's phobia. But it could explain, you know, sometimes weird behavior in horses that have always been treated kindly, and yet suddenly, you know, something happens and they just lose it.
Yeah, it definitely could. And, you know, I do certainly think that it comes into play, especially because one of the things that we find on a sort of a human level with past lives is that there's really an assumption that basically people around us are people that we've reincarnated with or been through things with in the past before. And the same is true with animals. Animal energies that are around us, many people feel that they're animal energies that have been around us in the past. For example, just within a past life example, I had a past life reading a couple months ago where the person was describing to me an animal that was that they saw me with in a past life, and I realized that was actually an animal that's around me now as well. And, you know, it really wasn't until the person started talking about it and describing what they saw with it that I realized that animal is here too. So, you know, I think it definitely shows that animals do have past lives, for sure. And I think the same things kind of trouble people with past lives could certainly trouble animals as well.
Yeah,
I also think that's why, you know, there's animals that come to us out of the blue that we really didn't expect, but suddenly, just like people, there's an instant connection with that particular animal, even though, you know, we may never have been around that animal before, might not ever have thought about that animal, but instantly we feel a connection with it.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, and I think that there are, and this is another one of my things. I think that there are people that don't like animals, and to me, I'm very sad for them because I think there's a piece of their spirit that is missing. And that doesn't mean that they're bad people. It just means that they're missing an aspect of compassion and understanding and all sorts of wonderful stuff. If they, you know, don't have animals around and around their lives, and you know, some of these people, they really don't want an animal and they don't care to have an animal, and you know, I just think they're crazy. But you know, but that comes from a fanatic. You know, I mean, I've got a lot of animals and you know, probably always will have. I can't turn a stray down. And but there are people that you know, just don't want to have anything to do with animals. And I kind of wonder sometimes just what is the makeup of their character that suddenly they don't want to have animals in their life. This is a very weird thing here. But you know, paranormal stuff and I think communicating with animals, you know, fits right in there. I think it's important for there to be more research, and I don't think there is that much research in it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, there's really not. You know, I mean, the thing about animals and the paranormal is that, again, a lot of people kind of brush things off without thinking about it too much. But with animals, for example, you know, there have always been stories of paranormal activity happening in someone's house. And, you know, later on they realize that, oh, you know, the dog or the cat didn't ever want to go down the hallway into a specific room.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the evolution of things, we actually have a sort of 20 questions that we ask people who have asked us to come in and do an investigation for them, or even are just sharing an experience. And in the last about 10 years of that, one of the questions that we actually added on was, do you have any animals in the house? And have they ever acted unusual or demonstrated any unusual traits that you've noticed? And with that question being out there, almost every time we get somebody that says, oh, yeah, now that I think of it, you know, my cat has had moments where she's constantly been looking around the room as if she sees something, and that's right around the time when I get a sudden chill. Or,
yeah,
you know, my dog always goes, you know, with me all over the house, but when I go into the basement, he comes down, but he won't go into the back corner. And so it's something that I think happens more often than we allow ourselves to think about, but it's just most people think, oh, it's just a cat acting strange, or it's a dog barking at nothing. But as soon as you kind of take it out of that context and put it in with other things, people start to realize, oh, yeah, you know, that could be. And on the farm, for example, the very first time we visited there, we were actually doing an investigation, and it was the first time that I had ever set foot on the farm. And I walked into one of the stables, which is an area where many people have had unusual experiences of things moving, of noises and such. And I walked in and I had night vision goggles on, so I was actually seeing with all the lights off. And one of the first things I noticed was that several of the horses had their heads out of their stall and kept looking at me and then looking down the hallway and looking back at me and looking down at the hallway. And, you know, I thought that was unusual, but I hadn't been around horses for a very long time. So I kind of just wrote down a note about it. And when we were sitting there going over some of the notes that we had, I noticed it and I said, oh, you know, I noticed the horses kind of doing this. Is that normal for them? And one of the people on the farm said, well, that's an area where we've had several experiences with. And looking back on it at that point, I felt like basically the horses were pointing out exactly where energy was, because they can certainly sense more than we can.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, it was every single one, looking at me, looking at the court, looking at so it was really undeniable to me that they most certainly had a sense that there was something there and were trying to tell me, you know, that that's what it was.
Yeah. No, I have found that cats, especially with spirits, they know when they're there. They can feel them, and they react to them. And I have often, you know, I don't feel it as fast as they do. And, you know, suddenly I'll notice that all of the cats are staring at one particular area. And when I focus on it, yeah, it's very clear what's going on.
Yep. And, I mean, that's what's really fascinating. There really hasn't, as you said, been very many sort of full studies done on animal, not just communication, but animal interaction with energies. And we're seeing it more and more in a lot of realms. For example, there's Reiki energy, which has been somewhat, there's been focuses on animals, and not just healing of animals, but basically energy exchange from animals, with animals helping people.
Yeah.
And I mean, personally, I had a situation with that several years ago. I had an illness, and I was in the hospital for a while. And when I came home, my cat, whom I still have now, sort of took on this different energy that I had never seen in her before. And because I was very exhausted, and I was laying around a lot, she almost took on this basically nursing instinct. And she would come up to me, and if she basically thought I was laying around for too long, she would come up to me, and actually she would start poking me. And she would poke me until I got up and acknowledged that she was there, and basically did something. And, you know, in a way, she really looked out for me, but I most certainly believe that she sensed that there was energy that was basically off with me, and she knew exactly what she needed to do to basically get me moving again.
Well, you know, the Chinese believe that cats draw heavy energy from people emotionally.
Right.
And I have often found when I did meditation groups in my home, I would always watch to see who the cats finally picked to sit on.
Yep.
Because I always knew that there was something emotional going on there, and that person needed healing of some sort. And they never failed to be absolutely dead on. It was really, and I don't think the cats, you know, they weren't, you know, looking around to see, you know, who really is a sicko tonight. They just were drawn to the need of an emotional need, an energetic need that was just most profound. I lose all of the time here tonight, I want you to talk a little bit about ears.
Sure. Well, ears is actually, it's the Emergency Animal Response Service. And what it is that it's actually an animal rescue service, and we don't do basically adoption and fostering. What we actually do is we go out on emergency calls. If somebody has, for example, a fire in their home, or if there's a major disaster, our team will actually go out and help. And it really developed in a lot of aspects, but, you know, again, being the interesting sort of merger of two interests between paranormal and animal, there's a lot involved with ears that is extrasensory, if you want to, you know, call it that, and can even be called animal communication, because there's a lot of focus on energy work with that, and mm-hmm. basically energy work with communicating with animals without using voice, without using cues, but basically projecting energy, making animals feel more comfortable in a highly stressed situation by basically sitting there with them. And in a way, it's meditation. You know, I consider it an energy exchange. You're basically putting out positive energy to make them feel comfortable. So it's interesting that, those two things do often merge together more so than, people might expect.
Well, and you like we've had several major storms here.
Right. And that's the other thing. You mentioned about, you know, animals being able to pick up on people. Animals most certainly pick up on energies in the general world as well. And other places like China and India have always understood that when the animals are reacting to something, they are trying to tell you something. They are trying to tell you that there's something major coming. And there's some studies that are actually looking into more of that, horses being one of them. Horses have the tendency to start acting up within hours of a major earthquake happening. So there's actually studies in California that are watching horses as almost a prediction method for earthquakes.
What about snakes coming out of the ground? I heard.
That's kind of one of those old school stories that snakes come out of the ground when there's possible earthquake activity. And that's very true. You see a lot of animals that are often burrowed underground coming above ground when they basically sense vibrations because they realize that there's shifting going on.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true with the tsunami that hit. It wasn't until afterwards, but there were all these stories in the days prior to the tsunami that people were reporting that they saw major flocks of sea birds that were heading inland, and it was unusual for that to happen. And then they realized days later they got hit with a tsunami.
Yeah. Well. Now, EARS is an organization that when we had the blizzard and animals were stranded, you go out and try to rescue the animals?
What our team actually does with EARS is we actually do basically what's called logistics and operations. In the case of the blizzard, there were many people that couldn't reach their animals to help them in the cases of people that owned horses and barns where the horses needed to be fed, but people simply couldn't get to the barns to do it. There were also situations where people were snowed in their roads and couldn't get out to basically get food for their animals as well. So in those situations, what we do is we will coordinate with basically a rapid response for those people and try to really help them out and get what they need for themselves and their animals. In the case of something like a hurricane like we had with Hurricane Sandy, so many people needed to evacuate their homes, but there's not very many shelters set up that are animal-friendly shelters, mostly because there's a large concern about keeping animals separate from people. And the ones that are there, there's a lot of restrictions. Many of them, you can only have one or two animals, and they have to be in cages all the time. That has animals often doesn't have just one. And also often, you know, animals don't do well in cages, especially if they're used to being a house animal.
Yeah, when I lived in Westport, this goes back into the 70s, I had six animals. I had three cats and three dogs. And there was a huge storm surge, and the house was surrounded by water. We lived right on the water. And when the National Guard came in to evacuate, they wouldn't take the animals. And so my son and I stayed in the house.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't going to leave the animals unattended. And, you know, and that was it. The National Guard never came back to see if I was fine.
Yep. And the other thing that a lot of people don't think about as well is, of course, larger animals. If you have a dog and a cat, it's a little easier to, you know, stick them in a car or stick them in a crate. If you have a horse or a larger animal like that, it's not so easy. you might not think about it, but there's a lot of towns where people do have larger animals that are not thought of as being large animal towns. You know, there's places like Milford that there's actually a lot of horses in Milford. And Milford is, you wouldn't think of Milford as being a horse town, but there's many people that have one horse on their property or two horses. And in an emergency, like a storm, those people are often worse off than somebody that has multiple horses, and certainly somebody that has a larger stable or stall.
Yeah. Well, there are people that have a lot of llamas, too, I'm noticing around this
yep.
area.
Yep, alpacas are definitely one, and even sheep and goats. A lot of people now are starting to keep sheep and goats on their property. You know, same thing with that. Not a lot of local shelters are available for people that might have a goat.
So EARS is a nonprofit organization.
Yep, we are. And we're actually you know, we're based here in Connecticut, so.
And you have a website for it, which is?
Oh, yep, the website is earsct.org.
Okay, and you know, if anybody is interested in donating or checking up how they could help you out with what you're doing, that information is all on the website, right?
Yep, it is. And we even have a version of our newsletter that's up on the website that people can see as well. So
I think it's such an important thing, and I don't think it's something that's been addressed enough in the past, that you know, these animals that adopt us, because frankly anybody who really has pets, you know, they're owned by the animals. They don't actually own the animals at all. And you know, there are times when we just can't care for them the way they need to be cared for. I know that you know, when we were out of power for 5-6 days, I mean, my cats were fine, but you know, if I had had to leave the house, I would have, I don't know what I would have done. That would have been, I'm sure they wouldn't have eaten each other, but I would have worried about food and water and all sorts of stuff. And you know, to know that there's an organization out there that can, in an emergency, help to sort of bridge that gap between when you can and cannot, you know, take care of your animals. I think the farm, what they do is amazing. And, you know, I did visit there, and I mean, my goodness, they got pigs and they got all sorts of animals all over the place. And what I love is, you know, they not only take in the animals there at the farm, but they also, the horses especially, they teach handicapped children how to ride on them, so that they have not only rescued animals that were in danger of being, you know, that they were neglected and they were abused, and they've turned it around so that they can actually help children and have a positive experience for everybody.
Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, especially with the farm itself, you know, every animal has a job, basically. And, mm-hmm. and it's almost as much to make them feel like, you know, they are welcome no matter what, you know. And there's many animals. Like we have a three-legged goat that's at the farm, and you know, a lot of people would say, well, what is he good for? Well, you know what, he's great for outreach, because kids can really identify with, you know, a goat that has basically a physical, you know, disability, but he gets around pretty well, and mm-hmm. you know, he's you know, accepted among everybody else. And animals have a lot to teach us, you know, if we're just really willing to actually pay attention.
Well, I think the coolest thing was I went there, that she doesn't have a watchdog; she has a watch pig, and and the pig literally is her dog, which is the coolest thing ever. You know, the pig greets you at the door, just about at the gate.
Yep.
But there, you know, it's such a wonderful atmosphere, and I'm so glad that there are places like the farm, and there are organizations like EARS, and of course SGRA for all of the other stuff. So I do want to thank you for actually being here on time, because I thought you were going to be late, and I was going to have
I thought I was too, but I used the wormhole to get home, so I was.
Oh, there. I see. but I'm going to want to have you come back on and talk to us more about everything that we've been talking about. But thank you so very much. You have made the evening phenomenal, and tons of people have been listening, and I hope we've put information out there that can help people. And your website is what? The SGRA website?
Yep, the SGRA website's easy too. It's sgra.org, and we're actually in the process of redoing the whole thing. So in about a week or so, there will be a completely new website that's up there for people.
Phenomenal. And you have workshops, and you have all sorts of information and activities going on that bridge the UFO to the hauntings to ears. I mean, you have so many pots you have fingers in, you run out of fingers.
Yep.
But I want to thank you so much, John, for sharing 2 hours with me, and we got to do this again sometime.
Sounds good, Barbara. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks again, and thank you, Jeannie, for being there. And we will see everybody on Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 for Past Lives with James Luce and me, and Jeannie, of course. Thank you, everybody, for dropping in tonight. It's been fun. Bye-bye now.